So once again, everybody, welcome to Carry the Message, Not the Wreckage. It's about winning the newcomer's confidence. It is a 12-step speaker workshop. I'll also be co-hosted with our GSR of the CA Service Sponsorship Group, Larissa. Thank you, Larissa, for joining us. And we're going to delve right into it. So as I said, my name is Cameron. I am a member of Cocaine Anonymous. My sobriety date is November 21st, 2003. And as a speaker and a facilitator of 12-step recovery, I've spoken to numerous AA, CA group meetings. I've spoken at district roundups, area conventions, a couple of CA world conventions. I've spoken to 12-step recovery audiences all across Canada, the United States, the UK, Europe. I've spoken on topics such as the 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts. Prior to my recovery years, I coached audiences on how to be better keynote speakers, including overcoming the fears of speaking, structuring your talk, dynamics for excellent presentations, powerful openings and closings, key messaging, etc. And it's my hope that this CA Service Sponsorship presentation will prove helpful to those of you who wish to carry a hopeful message to those who suffer from addiction in and across the world, rooms of 12-step recovery. So my take-home message to all of you here today is you're all going to become circuit speakers. Just out of curiosity, is there anyone here that's never spoken? Anyone raise your hand if you've never spoken at a meeting? Everyone's at least had an opportunity to speak at a meeting or perhaps a convention. Good. All right. Great. Okay. Carry the message, not the wreckage. Each individual in their personal stories describe in their own language. We don't need another Cameron F. We don't need another Chris R. We don't, you know, we want to hear you. So in your own language, and we don't want to just hear a big book regurgitated message either. You know, we can quote from the big book, but we want to hear in your own language, from your own point of view, the way you established your relationship with God. And our story helps clear the ground in our testimony. It bears witness to God doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. And that helps to sweep away any prejudices a newcomer might have that there is a power at work that's capable of restoring us to sanity. I believe every addict has a story, and somewhere in our fellowship, there is an ear that needs to hear your story. You know, your recovery story as an ex-problem addict is important. It's vital to our fellowship. A good share, a good effective share, will identify with those who struggle with addiction, and they will in turn identify with you. I'm like you, you're like me, you don't do it anymore, and I want what you got. How is that possible? You certainly have my attention. Please share with me how you're able to do that. And then by sharing what happened and what we're like today, the newcomer comes to believe that there's hope that they too can escape their difficulties. And that is how we can win the confidence of the newcomer. Now, carrying the message, not the wreckage, you know, our big book, and I quote from the big book here because everything I'm going to share with you is instructions within the big book. In terms of carrying the message that to those who suffer, we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. You know, the rooms, so often in the rooms, it should be about the good news. But what I hear a lot in some of the rooms is nothing but the bad news. Some of us have been to meetings like that where there's no solution, no, problem, like the Oprah Winefest or group therapy without a therapist. And that's really not what our rooms are about. You know, our stories, our narratives within the rooms should be about the good news. We're all experts in the problem, but what about the good news? There is a way out. And one of the things we don't want to do, have you ever been to a meeting where someone's turn to share and they take the room hostage and they won't shut up? Or we're talking and we should have wrapped up, you know, minutes ago, but we're continuing to carry on. And we really don't want to do this. And here's Joe Jones to tell us why we shouldn't do that.
You talk too much, you worry me to death. You talk too much, you even worry my pet. You just talk too much.
And unfortunately, you know, we far too often hear speakers share their drunkalogs, their war stories, their junkie pride tales, and even ramblings. I've heard speakers just ramble on incoherently about the minutiae of whatever's going on in their brain at that moment. I always know I'm in for a really long-winded war story when the speaker starts off with something like, I remember my first drink. I was in my mother's third trimester, and I realized I didn't drink like other fetuses. And I go, oh God, here we go, right? Oh my God. And it's 45 minutes of how to drink. I already know how to drink. I already know how to use drugs. I don't need any further intel in that respect. But I've been to speaker shares where unfortunately it goes on like that. Some speakers never know when to stop. Many times I've heard a speaker share on and on. And just when I think they're wrapping up, they're finally concluding, they digress into another stream of consciousness and go on and on ad nauseum. Know when to wrap up your talk. Know when to conclude your share. You don't want to leave your audience with the feeling that you talk too much. So what we're going to learn today over the next, this is about a 90-minute presentation. And one of the key messages, I don't want to see clones of Cameron F. out there. You know, my talk's my talk, and it's the way I construct it. But I want to share with you a lot of different ideas so that you can dare to be outrageously yourselves. That's what the audience wants to hear. They want to hear you, outrageously you, carrying that message of hope, faith, and courage. So you're going to learn to create your own style. The learning objectives that when we finish this presentation today, and as I said, I will post the slideshow that you're seeing now along with this audio. You're going to know 10 strategies for overcoming the fear of speaking in front of an audience, 5 ways to conduct yourself when speaking virtually or in person. Identify 3 major benefits of speaking to a 12-step meeting or an event. List 3 key elements for a compelling story. Identify 3 ways to win the confidence of newcomers. Know 3 essential components for a well-structured story. Learn 3 ways to dynamically open your share. Know 4 ways to identify and connect with your audience. Identify 5 important ways to describe what happened. 3 ways to inspire others to work their program. And lastly, 3 approaches to dynamically close your talk. Oh, I've added a slide here. We do this workshop is entirely free, but we do a 7th tradition, and it really helps us offset our Zoom costs. We have a website. And if you like what we're doing here today, and you think it's valuable, we try to do 4 of these workshops a year, and you would like to donate, you can donate at service, caservicesponsorship.org/7th-tradition. And we use PayPal. And even though we know your love is out there, there's something more to it.
Your love gives me such a thrill. But your love won't pay my bills. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want.
If some of you haven't already guessed, levity is one of my favorite spiritual principles that I love to convey to my audiences. Okay. Fear of public speaking. The fear of public speaking affects 1 in 4 people in the general public. So, question I want to put out, and I'm going to just stop the sharing for a minute here. What are some of the fears that we have when we're asked to speak? Perhaps you're being asked to speak at a large convention, or maybe you've been asked to speak at the World Convention or some big meeting where there's 100+ people. What are we afraid of? What goes with the fear of speaking in public? And let's take some thoughts from the audience here. Sandy, go ahead.
I might look stupid.
Yeah, that's really common. I might look stupid. I might screw up, right? Thank you. Good. Jackie.
I'm not going to have enough time.
Not have enough time. We'll have to play that song again. You talk too much. Or some people just overtly don't think they have enough to say, and that they'll speak and then there'll be a huge amount of time left open. By the way, the audience always appreciates when you finish early. They don't like it when you go over time. Larissa.
I trip over my words. I get stuck in the mess, not getting the message across.
Yep. We get tangled up, or we forget what we wanted to say, or, you know, we miss something and we get off track. Thank you. Joshua.
Specifically to recovery, like, I think I'm afraid that they won't think I'm authentic enough, that I'm not, that I don't really have the recovery that I'm bringing out in my speech.
Right. Yeah, you don't qualify. You're not good enough. You're not addicted enough, right? Yep. Appreciate that. Thank you. Rajiv. Rajiv, you need to unmute. There you go. Oh, unmute. Go ahead, Rajiv. Can you unmute yourself? Come on. The ability to use a computer is what separates us from being toilet-trained apes.
Yeah, I have a fear of public speaking. I may look like a rookie.
Okay. A fear of public speaking. What was the rest of that, Rajiv?
Like, I look like a rookie, even that I've never done this before.
Ah, a rookie. Got it. Yeah, looking like a rookie. Come on. This is a
the audience is not having a good time.
This is a perfect. I've had that effect on audiences. I spoke at one audience. It was called, I won't tell you the name of the meeting, but they had a big banner across the room that said, hang on, I'm going to mute everybody here for a sec. They had a big banner that said, meeting makers make it. And I'm not a big meetings maker. I'm a 12-step person. So I did my share. And this is one of my, I think it was my very first share I did. It was an audience of about 60, 70 people. And when I finished it, there was dead silence. They didn't even clap. It was just dead quiet. And then I heard a woman go, well, I didn't like that at all. It was a bit painful. Jenny, go ahead. Jenny, can you unmute yourself there? Jenny M?
I'm here.
Say that again, Jenny. I didn't get that. That was breaking.
Can you hear me?
I hear you now.
Oh, okay. You hear me now? Okay. So when I speak, it's like I look out into the audience and I'm like, are they looking at me? And if they're not looking at me, what are they doing? And if someone goes, or just makes any kind of like gesture that, you know, I like read into that and then I choke up and I'm like, oh my God. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I get it. Yeah. And some audiences will not like your message. I've had that happen where I've actually had to run to the door and escape the persecution. Go ahead, Rose.
Hi. For me, it's judgment. I always worry, like, what are they thinking? Do they think that I know what I'm talking about? Or am I carrying the message the right way? Am I talking about something too much? And I'll look into someone's eyes and I'll just get this, if I get this wrong feeling from them, they may be just like, you know, listening to what I'm saying. And then I'll get all tense up and I'll get nervous. That's happens with me.
Thanks, Rose. You know, one of the things I've learned over the years in speaking is like my talk is generally the same talk. You know, there's only so much I can share without having to make stuff up. And, you know, I can share with one audience and they go crazy. They loved it, you know, standing ovation, they coming up, lining up, and all sorts of things. And then the very same talk at another audience and it's dead quiet. So, you know, and anyone who's done any acting or stage production, who's had opportunities to present in front of audiences will know, you know, it's usually not you. It's just the way in which the audience sometimes engages with you. So, yeah, I can appreciate that. How do I say Abdul? Come on in.
Yes, Abdul. Yeah, you said it perfect, Kevin. Actually, Rose said what I wanted to say. It is most of all fear of judgment and judging myself already about, yeah, what can I add to add with my talk, that kind of things.
Right. Thank you. Joey?
Hi, Joey Addict. Thank you very much, Cameron, for this workshop. It's awesome. I guess this is having that when you look at the audience when you're halfway through your talk and you're getting that glazing look like, would this guy just shut the fuck up, you know? And thinking like, okay, am I sharing an effective message here? Because everybody looks disinterested, you know, and how to get them back, you know, how to pull them back onto the fish hook, you know? That's really been my biggest, you know, issue, especially when I'm speaking in the Netherlands, because, you know, speaking to a foreign audience. So that's always been like a huge, how you say, a huge issue of mine. That's it.
You know, and again, audiences can be even, you know, when I go to a share, I try to be very polite and courteous and hear the speaker out. First of all, I'm trying to learn what it is they're trying to teach me. And sometimes they teach me what not to do. I remember I went to one meeting. It was about 350 people in the audience. This was in person. And I went to the podium. And as soon as they introduced me, 15 people stood up and stormed out. Made a big display of their displeasure of me having to speak at their group. That sometimes it just goes with the territory, folks. But there's ways to deal with it and be centered and how to handle those types of situations when they pop up. We're going to hear from Chris, and then we're going to go back to our presentation. Go ahead, Chris.
Me, Chris? Chris Alcoholic. My fear is I'm gonna cry too much. I'm a crybaby, and, you know, I get too vulnerable. You know, or go too long.
Right. Yeah. Nice. And you know what? Sometimes I know some speakers, they turn the snot and tears on like a faucet, right? They just cry on command. I've never shed a tear. And my wife thinks there's something seriously wrong with me. So like I've killed off my inner child or something. But sometimes, you know, a heartfelt moment at the podium, you've touched on an aspect of your story that's very powerful. The audience can sometimes really resonate with that. But, you know, don't be surprised if some people in the audience really get the eye rolling. Oh, God, not the snot and tears again. But that's just the way audiences can be. So thank you, Chris. All right, back to our presentation here. So the fear of public speaking, as it says, it affects one in four people. So the question is, well, let's go to this question first. Do you know what people are most afraid of? You think it would be public speaking, but it's actually not public speaking. It is spiders and snakes. Spiders and snakes are the two biggest fears out there in that what people experience when it comes to fears. My son breeds spiders and snakes. What a kid. So question is how do we overcome our fear of public speaking? Well, I suggest you deliver a presentation on spiders and snakes. As I said, levity is one of my favorite spiritual principles. So, more seriously, though. Okay, 10 strategies for overcoming the fear of public speaking. The question is, and I hear this, you know, some people have accused me that, you know, oh, I'm training speakers, you know, cardboard speakers, people who stand in front of the mirror and rehearse their presentation word by word, and that it lacks spontaneity. And that's not what I'm suggesting here in this presentation. The question, though, of spontaneity versus stream of consciousness. And so many times I've you know, heard speakers go to the podium, they have no idea what they're going to say. And they start talking about whatever stream of consciousness comes into their mind in that given moment. And this can be an impediment when it comes to delivering an effective message. The problem with stream of consciousness is sometimes it's a great presentation. And other times it's a bust. But the problem with the stream of consciousness is that at the end of it, I really can't duplicate if it was magical and it really hit the audience well and it was one of the best talks I've ever given. I can't duplicate it because it was just whatever was in my head at the moment and it got spewed out. So I believe that in structuring your presentation, you don't have to memorize it word for word. I'm not suggesting that, but to structure your presentation, know what your key messages are, how you want to convey certain points about your story to the audience. And I really suggest you avoid a stream of consciousness sharing. I suggest you write down your presentation, use your own words. You want to avoid jargon and vulgar language, like that one talk, my first talk for the person in the audience said, well, I didn't like that at all. I remember I opened my presentation with, I went to the front of the room and I looked at my audience and I said, physically, I'm fucked. Emotionally, I'm fucked. Mentally, I'm fucked. And spiritually, I'm fucked. My name's Cameron and that's why I drink and use. Now, in CA, I can have a little more fun with the audience because, you know, my experience with CA audiences were a little grittier, were a little more raw in carrying our message. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I share my story in Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not swear. They just won't hear it. You start swearing in generally in an AA audience, if you start using vulgar language, your presentation will either be shut down or people will get out and walk away. So I've learned that they really can't, they really won't listen. No matter how good the message is, they won't listen because the vulgar language gets in the way. So the key message here is to know your audience. Occasionally, I've been asked to speak in Narcotics Anonymous. Narcotics Anonymous uses a very different narrative than what we're used to in CA and AA, which is generally a narrative out of the big book and big book focus. They have a different approach. So when I speak in NA, I have to be very mindful of I'm still talking 12 steps, but the words I'm using and how I'm conveying that to my audience is different. I don't talk about the big book when I carry a message in NA. I use words like clean rather than sober, because that's the vernacular of their particular fellowship. Also, you want to avoid jargon. Here in Toronto, Ontario, there was a group of big book thumpers that became very prevalent within the meetings, and they used jargon. There's a passage in the big book where we talk about the different types of drinkers. The moderate drinker, they can take it or leave it alone. The heavy drinker, looks like an alcoholic, but given sufficient reason, they can stop, like falling in love, warning of a doctor, you know, medical attention, whatever. And then there's the real alcoholic. And they would call the moderates type ones, they would call the heavy drinkers type twos, and the real alcoholic or addict type three. And so you'd hear a speaker go, well, I'm a type three addict. Well, unless your audience is in on the jargon, they haven't got a clue what you're talking about. Now, I don't mind using jargon, but if you're going to use it, you got to define your terms when you're in your talk. So generally use your own words, and I suggest you avoid, you know, jargon and vulgar language in your presentation. And like I say, you got to know your audience. I'm a bourbon drinker. And when I would drink bourbon, it really brought out a nasty side of me. I created a joke that I used initially in some of my early talks where I said, I think they should market bourbon like cigarettes. You know, you buy a pack of cigarettes, they have a picture of diseased lungs and they're really offensive, you know, as a way of trying to deter people from smoking. Well, I think bourbon should be marketed the same way. They should have a picture of a woman on the bottle with a black eye. And nobody in the audience laughed. And it became really apparent that that was just too close to home for men who might have acted or women who acted out violently or those that were subject to that violence. So you really got to understand your material and know your audience when presenting. And the last thing, the third point is to rehearse your presentation. Practice, practice, practice. And you get a lot of opportunities in the rooms to practice your presentation. I would often go to a lot of different discussion meetings where they had a topic, and I would use that as an opportunity to rehearse and try out the material of my talk. And I would put out a key message when it was my turn to talk. And I would watch how the audience responded to it. And it gave me an idea whether the material was hitting the point or missing the point entirely. So rehearse your presentation. I don't suggest you stand in the mirror and practice talking to yourself. But, you know, try out your talks in the rooms. Okay. Next on the list. Before you speak, this is point number four. Before you speak, take time for prayer and meditation. You know, before I talk, I get very centered. You know, I make sure I go to the bathroom. I'm well centered physically. You know, I sit at the back of the room. I start breathing. I do a short prayer. You know, I love the prayer in the big book. Instead, we let God demonstrate through us what it can do. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what God would have us be. And at once we commence to outgrow fear. So before I'm asked up at the podium, you know, I get very relaxed, relax my body. I calm my emotions. I still my mind. And I just visualize my performance, you know, and I build a clear picture of what that's going to look like and the success of my talk. And I find that really helpful, and it disarms me from being, you know, fearful or apprehensive about what I'm about to share. Number five, when speaking, focus on your audience. Most importantly, focus on carrying the message to the newcomer. If I focus my thoughts on me and how good I want to look to my audience, I start getting really nervous and I start getting very mindful of what I'm going to say. And I don't want to forget what I want to say. And I'll lose my train of thought when speaking. And then I get flustered. So instead, I focus on the newcomer. And I focus on who needs to hear my story in the audience. Who can I reach with that message of hope, faith, and courage that there is a way out of the hole? Remembering my primary purpose is to carry the message to the addict that still suffers. Now, the next thing you want to do is record your talk. We all got smartphones. When you're asked to go to the podium, take your phone up with you, hit the voice recorder on your phone, and record yourself. Listening to yourself after your talk is really good feedback. It helps you understand what's working and what's flowing. You may hear yourself say something, I don't quite like the way I said that. Maybe I can adjust that. And, you know, very early on, it was back in 2008, I was asked to do a share at a meeting outside my hometown here in Toronto. And, you know, I know I'm a pretty good speaker. So I thought, you know, I'm going to record this share. So I went and I did my share and I recorded it. Some of you may have heard it from St. Catharines in 2008. And there's a baby crying in the background as I'm delivering my talk. Who brings a baby to a meeting? Anyhow, so I recorded it and I listened to it afterwards. And I thought, this is a really good recording. And at the time, xa-speakers.org was the hub of all 12-step speakers. They had 12-step speakers from AA, CA, NA, Kohanon, Al-Anon, CODA, Sex, Love, and Addicts. They were the go-to hub for 12-step speakers, and they were an Icelandic organization. Well, I called them up and I said, I just heard the most incredible talk. You got to get this guy's MP3 on your platform. And the guy I connected with said, well, send us the MP3. We'll get it up on our platform. So I sent my MP3 in. They posted it. And 23,000 downloads later, I've been invited all around the world to speak. Yes, it was a little bit of promotion. But, you know, that's the value of recording yourself. Record yourself when you speak. And often, too, when you're being asked to speak, maybe you're called by your fellowship to speak at an upcoming convention or a roundup. Often they'll ask, do you have a speaker share that our programming committee can listen to? Well, you got one and you can send it in. And that sometimes seals the deal that they go, we really like the way that this person carries the message and you're invited to share. So record yourself, listen to yourself afterwards, make lots of notes and revise your share accordingly. Number 8, remember, you'll never have a more accepting and forgiving audience. You know, everyone in the room wants you to do well. Everyone is there. They're behind you. We've all been in the same position and they're going to clap no matter how bad you think the presentation might be or how bad the presentation will be. I've heard terrible speakers and we still clap. We still acknowledge the time and the energy they took to come and be at this event and present. Share from the I perspective. Hang on a sec. We got people wanting to come in the room here. There we go. Share from the I perspective. You want to avoid using you language. You know, using I, when you use the I perspective, it's your talk. No one can take it away from you. I did this. I was that. I experienced this. It's you own it. But sometimes we'll hear speakers, they get into the you language. You need to do that. You should do this. And it gets preachy. And I don't think any of us like preaching or being preached to. So avoid the you language. Speak from the I perspective. And of course, lastly, have lots of fun. When I started focusing on my audiences and carrying my message to the audience and reaching those that suffer, I found the podium and the front of the room a lot of fun. Beforehand, I never really enjoyed it because I always focused on Cameron and how well he should look and hopefully they'll like me and all that sort of stuff. And when I discarded those perspectives and just focused on carrying the message to the person who suffers in the room, the whole energy around it shifted. Okay, 5 ways to conduct yourself when speaking virtually or in person. Now, in a virtual meeting, and a lot of us are speaking virtually, one of the things I noticed when COVID hit, all of a sudden I became accessible. I was already doing some circuit speaking by that point, but I became really accessible to the fellowship around the world. Not every fellowship has the finances to fly a speaker across, you know, the ocean and put them up in a hotel and cover their expenses and so forth. So speaking virtually allowed a lot of good speakers to really get out there and carry their message in a lot of ways. I think I've done well over 600 keynote shares when COVID hit and being asked to speak at meetings and roundups and you know, online events since then. And I'm all talked out. That's why I'm hoping you guys will join me on the circuit and give my voice a rest so we can hear your story. So virtual meetings. Before presenting, take a look at yourself in the mirror or on camera. Make sure you have your close-up personal face on, right? Women, you might make attention to makeup and that sort of thing. You know, you want to look appropriate. You want to sit comfortably in your chair. I don't recommend you stand and speak, or, you know, you want to sit comfortably in your chair and you present to your camera. I recommend you use a laptop or a desktop computer rather than your smartphone. Sometimes if that's all you got, that's all you've got. But you want to make sure your screen's tilted correctly. You don't want the screen tilted where people are looking up your nose, or you don't want your screen too high that they can see your bald spot. You want to make, you know, at eye level, and, you know, make as much virtual eye connection as you can with your audience. And when you're speaking to your Zoom audience, I always pick different squares. And when I'm speaking, I look at that person. I especially look when I see someone laughing or engaged with me. Sometimes I will focus on that individual as I'm speaking, because I've obviously made a connection with that person virtually, and it's fun to speak to that person. So watch the facial expressions in your audience. Are they engaged? Are they smiling? Are they laughing? Are they nodding heads? Or are they turning their cameras off and doing whatever? We really can't do a lot about that. But, you know, sometimes that could be an indication that you might be losing your audience. Smile, speak clearly, modulate your tempo for emphasis. You know, sometimes I'll talk, you know, I'll put a lot of information quickly out there. Sometimes I pause for effect and so on. I love the virtual presentations. They're so much easier than traveling and all the challenges that go with in person. But I do get asked to speak still to this day in person. I've got one coming up June 10th, the 90th anniversary of AA, and I've been invited to do a boat cruise up a river along with my wife. My wife generally does not join me on my speaking tours, but she's invited on this one. We're doing a boat trip and I get to speak in live. So that'll be a lot of fun. You want to be well-groomed, dress appropriately. Even in virtue, you want to dress appropriately. You know, lately I've been, I did a 12-step 4 hours workshop the day before New Year's, and I always put a tux on for the New Year's presentation. But I got to thinking, I really look good in a tux. I think I'm going to wear a tux every time I speak. So I'm always in a tux when I'm speaking. And it's nice to be, I handle myself differently when I'm well-groomed and presenting. So I like to dress appropriately, especially in person. When you're speaking in person, I recommend you stand in one place. Do not pace back and forth on the stage. Now, some speakers can do that. Like if you ever get a chance to watch a 1980 speaker, Tom Peters, he was always moving on stage, but he moved in a way that was compelling and dynamic. I find it can be distracting. So when I go to the podium, I plant my feet in one spot and I'm speaking to my audience from that position. I make eye contact. I look at different people in the audience. I focus on a person. I talk to them for a while. Then I focus on another person, talk to them, talk to the person at the back of the room, talk to the person in the front row. And I just move throughout the audience trying to engage people directly as I'm presenting. If there's no mic, and sometimes you'll be asked to speak in a room and there's no mic. So you want to be able to say it loud, say it proud, and project your voice. So when I speak, when there's no mic at the podium, I'll speak and try and talk to the person in the back of the room. I want to be able to modulate and fill the room that way so everyone can hear the message. Sometimes I've heard speakers and they speak so quietly that you can't hear them and you miss what they're having to say. So say it loud, say it proud. Take note of your audience's engagement, just like you would on a virtual meeting. Are they engaged? Are they smiling? Are they laughing? Are they nodding their heads? You know, see if you're connected, and smile and speak clearly and modulate your tempo for emphasis. It's really, you know, the one great thing about in-person meetings, which I really love, and those of you that have presented and experienced this, or those of you that are engaged in acting or, you know, doing stage work, sometimes you connect to the audience in a way, and the audience is connected to you and you're connected to them, and you're feeding the audience and the audience is feeding you. And it's a magical moment as a presenter when you get that with your audience. It doesn't happen all the time, but when it does happen, it's like God's grace just breathing through you and to you. It's really quite magical when that happens. And it will happen for you from time to time with different audiences. One last thing I'll say about virtual meetings too. You can work with cheat notes, right? You know, because they only see you from the torso up. They don't know if you've got your notes or your presentation in front of you. So, you know, the virtual meeting is a great way to cheat when you're presenting too, if you want to make sure you cover all your key points. In person, sometimes you can take your notes to the podium if they have a lectern and that. But, you know, I love the virtual meetings for that that aspect also. Okay, three benefits of speaking. One, it fulfills tradition five. Our primary purpose is to carry the message of our hope, faith, and courage to the addict that still suffers. The reason I speak is it's being of maximum service to God and my fellow human beings. And as I said, meetings should be about the solution. They're a pep rally for the spiritual way of life. And let's communicate that we're in their rooms. You know, there is a solution. Let's impart that hope, faith, and courage that there's a way out of this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So that's the number one benefit about speaking and carrying your story to those that suffer. Three benefits of speaking again. Number two, when we speak, it reinforces our identity of who we are as members of a 12-step program. Now, I went back to university in my 50s, because there's a line in the big book that says, quote, see what other religious people are doing. So I thought, I'll go get a degree in religions. And I also studied medical anthropology, which is the study of humans and their healing system. And one of my professors had done a longitudinal study in Food Addicts Anonymous about the different genres of their narratives, their stories. And like most fellowship, it comes down to two recovery genres, the recovered addict versus the recovering addict. And recovery stories, how we share our recovery story is very consequential in the sense that the person's experience of recovery, the telling and retelling of an empowered, recovered narrative with its clear beginnings, its turning points, its favorable results, has been studies have shown that it's critical for a stable and consistent recovery. What she found was, is those identified as recovered members, that where the old life was the old life, it's gone, it's been let go of, they've been reborn into a new way of living, and a clear delineated boundary between the old life and the new life, she found that group of narratives showed and maintained consistent abstinency, which was really amazing. And so they found that such narration, the articulation of our story in that perspective, would facilitate the member's consistent affiliation with their appropriation of these 12-step narratives. Now, just as conversely, and this is an old argument in the rooms, recovering versus the recovering versus recovered, she found that the telling and retelling of an ambiguous, I'm always recovering narrative. A lot of treatment centers use that. Oh, we're always recovering. We're just an arm's length away from the next drink, you know. And she found in these narratives that the addict didn't necessarily think the old life was that bad. They weren't really crazy about the new life. They often, you know, pondered these hypothetical life paths that they didn't actually pursue. They envision abstinence as both good and bad. And what they found was it perpetuated this cyclical life course in which relapse would occur. I think that's where that, and it's not our program, relapse is part of recovery. No, I don't think it is. We do relapse when we don't have power, but I don't think it's part of recovery. And she found that the recovering narratives were always relapsing and permanent sobriety often eluded them. So how you identify in your share can have a bearing also on your abstinent rate, on your ability to be a recovered member of permanent sobriety. I know this is kind of heady, and you know, I'll post the slides so you can have this information, but I found it a fascinating number of papers I was reading about these ways of identifying as members in a 12-step program. Another research had found that central to the 12-step recovery culture is the personal story of the recovered addict. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And this is mentioned in our big book. The member's personal story reinforces the figured world of 12-step recovery. These narratives maintain our boundaries that structure and empower the 12-step recovery culture. And by sharing our personal stories of what we used to be like, members identify as addicts. Their war stories convey important criteria for potential members to identify and label themselves as addict too. Hey, I'm like you, you're like me. And so there's that connection, that identification that comes in the sharing of our stories. Lastly, our personal testimonies are significant to the newcomers because the storylines of recovered addicts objectify the central cultural elements of our 12-step world, such as the importance of attending meetings, getting a sponsor, helping others, suffering addicts, doing service work for the 12-step group. And by listening to the narratives of recovered members, newcomers learn the culture of 12-step recovery. The newcomer learns the model of 12 steps through the testimonials by listening to the members telling their story. And the newcomer comes to understand their own life as a member of a 12-step program. So the 12-step languaging provides a very attractive element. It connects the newcomer to our 12-step culture and assures them that drinking, using, or the acting out problem can be solved. And this results in these behavioral transformations of newcomers, these profound alterations in our reaction to life. You know, up until the 80s, there was a significant shift in the AA program from the 50s to the 80s, where the big book was almost lost. A lot of it was 12 and 12, and a lot of it was being changed by the treatment center industry from into action and working the steps to more of into discussion, a problem shared is a problem have, and the belaboring of the war story. And by 1970, by the 70s and early 80s, that's all you heard were war stories. Long, belabored, 40, 45-minute war stories, drunkalogs. And what that was doing, as each speaker did that, it reinforced that this is how we tell a story. And it got to a point that's all you were hearing. And thank God for Joe and Charlie, who came out in the 80s with the Big Book Revival. And then Wally P. wrote Back to Basics about the early beginner meetings of the 1940s. You know, Chris R. and Mark Houston, who started the Cliff Bishop, the primary purpose groups out of Austin, Texas. You had Billy S. from the East Coast of America, the Back to Basic Step Studies. We got Richard E. in London, England with the Richmond Group and all these kind of big book revival stories about being recovered versus recovering. So the whole thing about this is how we tell our story can have not only a bearing on our own recovery, but sets the template for how in which we identify and behave and interact within the culture of 12 steps. Last benefit of speaking, you know, Bill W. suddenly realized in order to save himself, he must carry the message to another alcoholic or addict. It's important for them, the newcomer, to realize that your attempt to pass this message of experience, strength, and hope onto them plays a vital part in our recovery. Actually, they're helping you more than you're helping them. So the third big benefit is towards ourselves. By carrying the message to those that suffer, we in our own turn manage to maintain our permanent recovery. Okay, three key elements for a compelling story. So number one is structure. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. The Big Book gives us very specific instructions on how to carry our message. What we used to be like, not what it was like. So often I hear what it was like. It's what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. Our story needs substance. The message which can interest and hold these addicted people must have depth and weight. I remember someone called me up and says, Cameron, my girlfriend thinks I have a cocaine problem. I said, really? Well, explain that to me. He said, well, I'll pick up a gram of powder and I'll do a few lines and then I'll put it away. And then maybe next week I'll do a few more lines and put it away. And next week I'll do a few more lines and put it away. And over the course of a month, I'll consume about a gram of cocaine. And then for the next month, I'll buy another gram. Now, for those of you that use cocaine, what's wrong with that story? I said, let me explain how I do a gram. I get a gram. It cost me $150 a gram, and I was making $2 an hour in those days. So you got an idea of how broke and poor I was most of the time. And I would take my gram, and I'd cut it into three piles. I'd put my gear on the table, my needle, my spoon, and I would do the first third. And within 3 minutes, I got my ringer, and then I'm hanging for a second hit. I do the next third. I get my ringer, and 3 minutes later, I'm hanging for another hit. And then I do my third third, and then I'm hanging. And then within 10 minutes, I've injected a gram of cocaine. I'm broke. I'm out of cocaine. I'm squirting water in the spoon and doing what I call the wash 10 times over, hoping some way I'm going to get high on what little residue might exist in the spoon. That's how I do a gram. You know, our message has to have depth and weight. And the depth and weight that our stories convey, the one thing that binds us all together as addicts, regardless of what your addiction may be, whether it be alcohol, whether it be drugs, whether it be the acting out addictions like sex, love, food, gambling, hoarding, cutting, codependence, whatever. The one thing that binds us all together, the one thing we'd love to do that we can't do, and that's control what we love to do best. We have no control, lack of control, lack of power to control what it is that we love so much. That's the one thing that binds us. That's the substance that interests and hold these alcoholic addicts type to go, I'm like you. I got no control. Nothing seems to stop this train wreck from happening, but you don't do it anymore. And I'm just like you and you're just like me. How is that possible? That's very compelling to someone who wants to stop but can't stop. And the third thing is the outcome. We believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems to the newcomer, they will be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, and I must have this thing, and we can take them on that amazing journey that we have called the 12 steps of recovery. So remember that we're here to carry the message, not the wreckage. We want to avoid the drunkalogs. We want to avoid the junkie pride stories. And as I said, I already know how to drink and how to use. I don't need any more intel. What the room really wants to hear is, how did you escape it? How did you get well? How did you recover? We want to avoid the Oprah wine fests and the open disgusting meetings and the group therapy without a therapist. So three ways to win the entire confidence of a newcomer. That's our goal. How do we win the newcomer's confidence? Yes, you're in the right place. Yes, we have a solution. Yes, you want to get a sponsor. Yes, you want to get involved. Yes, you want to recover. Yes, you want to carry the message to those that suffer. How do we do that? So there's three things. Again, our big book gives us specific benchmarks on how to win the newcomer's confidence. So number one is, we're ex-problem drinkers or addicts. We don't do it anymore. That's very compelling to someone who wants to stop that can't stop, and they meet someone who has stopped. And we can do that in a number of ways. We can share the length of time we're sober. I'm not a really big fan of the sobriety time. I know it's something we accumulate, but I often say if you're counting your time, you're doing time. I think time matters a lot to the newcomer because they can't put any time together. But in the long run, that's really not the question I ask when I'm working with other people in the rooms. You know, people come up to me and say, hey, Cameron, how much time you got? And I go, why is that important? And they go, oh, I understand you don't have a lot of time. I go, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just wondering, why is time so important to you? Well, it tells me how long you've been sober. I get that, but that doesn't really tell you a lot about their program. Question I ask, which tells me everything about a person's program, is, are you working with newcomers? As they go, yeah, I'm working with newcomers. That tells me a lot about their program. So we're ex-problem addicts. Two, we got a solution. I got a way out of the hole for you. It's called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a recovery recipe whereby you can find a power greater than yourself, greater than you, greater than the booze, greater than the drugs, greater than the acting out addictions, where you can easily control your desire to do that and recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And the third thing is I'm properly armed with the facts about myself. I know what it means to be an addict. I understand addiction. I've lived in that hole. You know, the anthropologists call us wounded healers. We earn the right to carry our message and our healing approach because we've been wounded ourselves by the very addiction that we've healed from. And so those three things come together, we can generally win the entire confidence of another addict in just a few hours. But until such an understanding is reached, there's little that can be accomplished. So my goal as a speaker is to convey those elements to my audience. I'm an ex-problem addict, I got a solution, and I'm armed with the facts about myself. So there's three types of shares. You know, often we get a chance to go around the rooms and introduce ourselves. You know, that's a short, less than a minute share. Sometimes we're asked to chair a meeting and we might be asked in our preamble to qualify. This is an opportunity to identify, and we got 3 minutes or less to do that. And then, of course, we have the main speaker share where we share our hope, faith, and courage. And it could be a 20-minute share. Sometimes I've been asked only to share 10 to 15 minutes. Other times I've been asked to share a full 60 minutes. So we have a main speaker share. Now, you want to know your talk so well that you have a 15-minute, 30-minute, 45-minute, 60-minute version of your talk. Because sometimes I've been asked, oh, please come and share your story, Cameron. You'll have about 40 minutes to share your story. But it's a medallion. And everybody loves a medallion. And everybody wants to congratulate the person getting their medallion. Which I find really odd. You know, I would think that the person who's getting the medallion, who's got whatever a length of time of sobriety they're celebrating, I always thought they should be the speaker so they can share with us how they got to the point where they're getting a medallion. But somehow we always invite someone else to share for us. But sometimes things will go on in a meeting where your sharing time is cut short. So if you're all prepared for a 40-minute talk and then you realize the meeting's almost over and you only got 15 minutes to carry your message. In fact, I was at a meeting earlier this year where I was supposed to get at least 30 minutes and all they had for me was 7 minutes. I had to deliver something in 7 minutes that was meaningful to this audience. Now, I know my share well, and I, you know, kind of quickly mentally calculated what key message did I want to share in that period of time, and it hit the mark. But I wouldn't have been able to do that if I had been prepared for a 30-minute share and then derailed at the fact that I've only got 7 minutes. That could be really unnerving to someone who's not used to, you know, rearranging their talk depending on the amount of share they get. Sometimes, you know, I don't do it as much now because I'm a lot more flexible. But earlier on, I wouldn't take a share that I didn't get at least 30 minutes. I would tell them, I really can't deliver a talk in less than that time. If you want me for 30 minutes, I'd be more than pleased. If it's less than that, maybe you should find another speaker. And I've turned down speaking engagement. I don't do that anymore, but I did that earlier on because I was more comfortable at delivering 30, 40-minute shares. And as a speaker, you get to share. You know, it's your decision. You don't have to speak everywhere. So, and also I try to set some requirements, you know, the time I need to speak, will there be a mic if I'm in person? And I also ask my host to introduce me, right? Introduce the speaker. And I might say, here's what I'd like you to say when you introduce me. And then I tell them if it's in person, please wait at the podium for me to come up, shake your hand, acknowledge that you've introduced me and that you're giving the space to me to present. You know, it's just a nice classy way of handing the power back and forth. You know, so when I go up to the room, there's the person introduced me, I shake their hand or I give them a hug, and then I take over the podium. It's like they're saying, okay, the stage is yours. And then at the end of my share and the audience is clapping, I wait for the person who introduced me to come back to the podium. I shake their hand or give them a hug, and I turn the stage back over to them. It's just a nice, classy kind of way of, you know, the interactions that go on when you're asked to speak in person. Okay, introducing ourselves. I love introducing. I have so much fun in introducing who I am. So when sharing at a meeting, how should you introduce yourself? Now, the most common thing I hear in the rooms is, hi, my name is, I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, right? And I get that. We want to identify as alcoholics and addicts, especially when there's a newcomer in the room thinking, am I really in the right spot? And then you hear other people, well, I'm an addict, I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict. Oh, yeah, I'm in the right spot. I find that's the minimum. There's not a lot of content in, hi, my name's Cameron, I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict. I do not use, hi, my name's Cameron, I'm a recovering addict, recovering alcoholic. I just don't, that's not what I am. I might have been that way very, very early on in as I was being introduced to 12 step, but I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I can easily control my desire to drink, use, or act out. I've recovered. So I like, if I'm going to use recovered, my name's Cameron, I'm a recovered addict. When I'm asked if I'm going to introduce myself as a recovered addict, that's kind of a loaded word. So ideally, I have a little bit of extra time to define what it means to be recovered. I've been relieved of that merciless obsession where I have no choice but to drink or use. I have that problem has been removed and my mind and body has straightened out and I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So I like to define my terms sometimes if I'm using a word like recovered. Another way people can introduce themselves, and I've played with this a lot. My name's Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. It even says that in your big book early on. Most of the members, when they were asked to speak publicly, to introduce themselves as members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But again, like I'm an addict, it only says I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. I like to define what it means to be a member of Cocaine Anonymous. So the one I love using the most is, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. Now, I do two things with that introduction. I identify that I'm an alcoholic addict, but I also demonstrate and articulate that I have found a solution. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. Or I'm an alcoholic addict who knows how to stop. You know, either one. You can have fun playing with it. Sometimes when I'm in a room full of blue hairs, you know, a lot of stodgy old AAers, I haven't seen a newcomer in 30 years. They all just sit around celebrating their medallions. I remember being at one of these meetings and it came, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. Comes to me. I go, hi, everybody. My name's Cameron, intelligent agent, spearhead of God's ever advancing creation. It's great to be here. It gets them wound up. Oh my God, that sounds like a lot of ego. Oh geez, what's he talking about? Again, you know, enthusiasm. I think there's only one thing more contagious than enthusiasm in the rooms of 12 steps, and that's a lack of it. I love that phrase because it's very enthusiastic. And sometimes when I'm just being an ass and I'm having real fun, I'll introduce myself as, hi, my name's Cameron. I am a God that shits. That one just gets him. What did he talk about? That's actually a line I believe out of the book, the Spirituality of Imperfection. Mark Houston used to talk about that line. Okay, so have fun. Think of different ways to introduce yourself in the rooms. Remember, why do we introduce ourselves? Because we're carrying a message. We want to reach someone in the room who's suffering, who does not have a solution, whereby we introduce, and sometimes we only have the introduction to make ourselves known, to reach them and say, you know what? I like what that's about. I want to be an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use or knows how to stop because I'm dying with it, right? So have some fun with your introductions. Qualifying as an addict. What qualifies you to share a message? What are the facts about yourself? What can you say in 3 minutes or less that will persuade those in the meetings that, yes, I'm like you and you're like me, but you don't do it anymore? So quickly, I would say, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic who doesn't drink or use. Now, when you think about that, that's a rather paradoxical thing to say because everything in my experience tells me I will drink. I will use again. And to do so is to die. And I realized in the trajectory of my drinking and using from the age of 20 to 26, I love drinking and using so much, I can't seem to differentiate the true from the false. My mind lies to me every time, no matter how bad, how painful my debacles and my sprees are. My mind convinces me that this time, somehow, some way, I'll be able to drink and use again. And to do so is to die. Yet, as a member of Cocaine Anonymous, it's been over 21 years since I've had any desire to drink or use. How is that possible? Well, it's because I met someone in these rooms armed with the facts about themselves. They had a solution, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a generosity of spirit. And they showed me a way out of that inescapable hole. And as a result, I've rebuilt my entire life. I've done more in the last 21 years than I did in the first 46 years of my life. Rebuilt my marriage, celebrating 35 years of marriage, love and trust of my children, who I terrorized as an addict, as an alcoholic, the love of my 38-year-old daughter and my 41-year-old son. My liver went back to normal. I travel all over the world speaking in CA and AA. I've done all kinds of service for the fellowship. I love my life as a recovered addict. It's an amazing program, and you can have it too. It's a very simple program to work. And that's like 3 minutes or less. There's a lot of information conveyed in that. So you can have some fun with your qualification. That's your 3 minute, or what we call the elevator talk. And it's an opportunity to convey your lack of power, lack of control. It's an opportunity to demonstrate the old self versus the new self. So you can have some fun with the qualification part. Now, the main speaker shares. So you've been asked to speak, right? Been asked to speak at a meeting. Maybe they want you to speak at a convention. So what's the components of a main speaker share? And you can mix up the order of this. I mix up my order. It doesn't have to be sequentially 1 through 5. You can sometimes start with step point 4 and then go to point 2 and point 3, which is, you know, you can have some fun with it. You can mix it up. So there's your opening where you introduce yourself. Then you share what you used to be like. This is where we tell an effective war story and win the newcomer's confidence. Some people call it your jaywalker story. 3, share what happened. Now, this is the important part. What happened? What caused you to have a profound alteration in your reaction to life? How you hit bottom, reaching that turning point, found that jumping off place, that moment of clarity, and how you found and worked a solution. And then your bragging rights. The proof is in the pudding. Share what your life is like today. Talk about the promises fulfilled, how your life has taken on new meaning, how we found the fellowship we crave, and then close your talk with a signature sign-off. And I have a way of always closing my talk. I use pretty much the same phrase every time. So, you know, it's just my Cameron F. signature, and I'll come back to that in a moment. So opening your share, introduce yourself. You can tell a humorous analogy or short story, or you can cite a quote from the Big Book. So, like, my name is Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. And you can open up with all different kinds of analogies. I have a couple here. I used to tell, one way I sometimes open up is with a joke. So a hard user and a real addict go out and see the dealer. And the dealer says, I've got this magic 8-ball of crack cocaine. It is the best bling crack cocaine you'll ever smoke. It's a ringer every time you chip a piece off and smoke it. And here's the thing. It's magical. No matter how much you chip off the 8-ball, it never reduces in size. The hard user goes, well, I'll take one of those. But you know what the real addict says? You better give me 3. Right. So you can open up with a joke or, tell a short story. Some of you have heard my share where I talk about the addict that's fallen into a hole and he's crying out for help. And the family comes along and offers frothy emotional appeals, but that doesn't work. And then the church community comes along and reads scripture and prays for the person, but that doesn't work. And then the medical community comes along and offers them clorazepam, diazepam, perazepam. That doesn't work. And then the treatment center community comes along and that doesn't work, right? And then I close my story with, so when you hear the addict crying out for help in the hole, what should we do? Well, as ex-problematics, we should jump into the hole with them. And they're bewildered. Well, now we're both in the hole. And we can look to our brothers and sisters with a wink and an eye and say, it's okay, I've been here before. I got a way out. I got a way out with more hope, faith, and courage. A way out to walk hand in hand with the sunlight of spirit. A way out to be an intelligent agent, a spearhead of God's ever-advancing creation. And I'm for that. How about you? So you can tell a story, an analogy, or you can quote something from the big book. You know, one of my favorite quotes, if I'm talking about a big book message in my share, is I like to open with practical experience shows that nothing ensures immunity against drinking, using, or acting out as intensive work with other addicts. It works when all other activities fail. And of course, then I launch into my share about big book sponsorship. Richard E., who is the man who got the Richmond Group going in London. He's quite the character. He has one quote. I love this quote. It comes from page 95 in the big book. He holds up a big book and says, and his quote is, read this book. That's his way of opening. And I just thought it was a brilliant way to open up his talk. Okay, what we used to be like. How should we tell our war story? Again, our big book gives us specific instructions on how to do that. Tell the newcomer enough about your drinking, your using, your acting out, habits, symptoms, and experiences, and encourage them to speak of themselves. So I'm going to share some stuff about me and how my pattern of addiction looked, and you're going to share with me. You know, and, you know, that could be like when I share, I talk about everyday drinking, everyday using, talk about blackouts. I talk about the types of drugs I used and the ways I used. And then it goes on to say, tell them how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. There's a point, I think, in every addict's trajectory of addiction where they realize something's different about you versus the others. And the story I tell is when I realized there was something wrong with me. I used to work the financial districts of Toronto. And during the day, I'd be in a three-piece pinstripe suit. This was back in the 80s. And every Friday, there'd be a party at one of the people's posh condominiums or homes. And, you know, we'd all get together and all the men are still in their suits and the women are in their business attire. And we're at some very posh, luxurious apartment or home, and there's lots of drinking, and of course in those days there was a lot of good cocaine. And I remember being at this party, and I'm sitting on the sofa, and this guy beside me goes, Cameron, would you like a couple lines of cocaine? I said, I'd love a couple lines of cocaine. So I remove my suit jacket and I roll up my sleeves because I'm an intravenous cocaine user, and my arms are just buggered with track marks. And I put my gear on the table. I put a needle on the table, a spoon. And as he's cutting out my lines, I'm getting ready to shoot up. And the party stopped. It went dead quiet. And the hostess comes up to me and goes, what do you think you're doing? I said, well, I'm going to do my lines. And she goes, you can't shoot up like a junkie in the middle of our little soiree here. And I go, what? You're judging me on my delivery method? Is this what we're talking about? And I was politely asked to leave. And as I'm walking to the door with my lines, I'm thinking, I don't use like these people. There's something different about what I'm doing. And I got a hit of where I was, you know, there was something sick coming on with me, right? I didn't use like the regular person. Then give them an account of the struggles you failed. This is where we start to identify and arm each other with the facts about ourselves. I talk about all the failed strategies. I tried treatment. I tried going to meetings, having a sponsor. I tried doing personal development, pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralizing experience, trying to sober up for my children, my wife. All of these things failed me. And the persons in the room that I'm sharing them, yeah, I've done that. I've done that. I've done that. So there's this identification that goes on. And then I talk about all the things I lost too. I lost money, time, friends, and I lost my sense of self. I lost my volition and agency. I lost my confidence. I lost my humanity. I lost my hygiene. And they're going, yeah, I lost that. I lost that. I lost that. So there's an account of the struggles that we all identify with. And most of us, the things that we struggled to stay stopped and failed us and the things we lost are very universal. All addicts usually share the same thing. So there's a real opportunity to identify with one another. And then I talk about how the mental twist, how my mind lies to me, which leads me to my first drink or drug. And I always tell the story of the liar. I got a liar that lives in my head and that loves the effect produced by alcohol and drugs, and it doesn't want to give it up. So it works on reasons and excuses and justifications that somehow, some way, I'm going to be able to control and enjoy my drinking and using. And here's the problem. The liar would always win the argument. Addicts all identify with that kind of an analogy. So this, I'm able to establish a really strong connection with the audience or with my prospect when I can convey what we used to be like, which is kind of a universal experience for all addicts, even though our behavioral patterns will vary. But there are some universal aspects that we all identify with. And our big book has identified them in these 4 points. Then we talk about what happened, because this is the key point. Tell them exactly what happened to you. And they want you to, the big book encourages us to stress the spiritual feature freely, because you got to remember a 12-step program is a spiritual moral approach to the efficacy of addiction. It's not a secular, it's not a human, it's not a psychological approach, it's a spiritual moral approach. So we should share that aspect. We're the program of last resort, right? That's why most of us come to the rooms pretty badly mangled and beaten into a state of reasonableness. You want to describe your last bottom, that jumping off place, that moment of clarity where you came up for air and said, I don't want to go on this way anymore. And then talk about how you found a sponsor. You know, I found this guy. He was watching me. I was in sobriety in the first 8 months of my program, and I was just white knuckling it, and it was awful, and I'm dying, and I'm miserable. And this guy walks up to me who I knew. I knew what this guy was when he was out there. It was a pill popper, an alcoholic, the hopeless variety. And there he was, like Ebby Thatcher, fresh skinned and glowing. And he goes, Cameron, I'm watching you die. Would you like to have a way out? And I said, what happened to you? He goes, I found God. And I remember going, oh God, not that. But whatever he found, I knew something had happened to him, and he won my confidence, because whatever it was, he called it God. I wanted what he had. And that's how I found my sponsor. And we didn't go to another meeting. We went to a coffee shop, opened up big books, started doing instructions, and my life profoundly changed. Share your experience of attending meetings and how and when you started your step work. And then share about the service work you've done. You know, I've started groups. I've been a GSR. I've been secretary. I've been treasurer. I've done most of the positions at the area level. I've done, I spent 12 years at the world level on the conference floor. I've pretty much done everything in CA except be a trustee. And I love the service work. It's like the icing on the cake, you know, to actualize the principles of my program, to leverage out across a group, a district, an area, or the world, my ability to try and carry a message to those that suffer and bring that hope, faith, and courage. And then, of course, these are your bragging rights. What is your life like now? Talk about the promises fulfilled. Talk about your health and your family work and life and how it's changed, and share about the fellowship that you've found. And you know, like I said, you know, I got a wonderful marriage, a wonderful relationship with my children. My health is great. I'm 68 years old this year. I'm on no medication. My mind is sharp. I love the fellowship. I keep thinking of new ways to carry the message. In addition to talking, you know, I built 35, I can make a computer pretty much do anything. So I've, you know, built 35 area websites for the fellowship. I also built and maintained the world website currently. I've started groups. I have the 12 steps, 4 hours group. We just passed on March 30th. We've enrolled since May of 2007, over 14,000 people through the 12 steps, most of which we've done over since COVID started. In the last 4 years, we've taken well over 12,000 people through the 12 steps. I do TGF and the Midnight Rounders on Friday night. And this meeting here, Larissa and I work together and think of ways that we can convey the power of service sponsorship within the fellowship and being of service to our groups and our areas, because we need to hang together. Without the group is most important. We die alone. So, you know, Larissa and I love to expand on that and convey the importance of that within our fellowship. And I love it has been a stellar life living this program of 12 steps. And then, of course, you want to close your talk. You can have some fun. Again, you can tell a short story to wrap it up. You could tell another analogy. And then, or a big book quote. And I always, my signature sign off is, no matter what it is I'm sharing or what topic, I always close with, and I'm for that. How about you? God bless. See you on the firing lines of recovery. That's typically the way I sign off when I do my shares. As we wrap up here, I got just a couple more notes. One, as I said earlier on, we do have a seventh tradition. If you like this presentation, you think, man, that was good, I'd like to support that, please visit our website and make a donation to offset our Zoom costs and our website costs. We appreciate your support. You know, we do live on the earth plane here, which unfortunately does require money. And just to convey, this is another song about money that I love. Here it is. Money. And lastly, I look forward to hearing your sharer talk. I'm done talking. I want to hear you out there at your next 12-step recovery meeting or convention. Now, if you like, and I'm open to doing this, I'm retired and I do take the time. If you've got a share coming up and you'd like to work on it, you reach out to me and we'll set up a Zoom link and you can present to me your share as you do it and I'll record it. Then we can talk about it, things we can do to adjust it. I'll let you go back and listen to your share and make your adjustments. And then we can set up a second appointment where you can present your share to me again as you've adjusted it. And we can work on bumping up the level of which you share and convey your message and be the best possible 12-step speaker you can possibly be. And it'd be my pleasure to do that. I love being able to mentor and help others take over the circuit and give me a break. And I've also included a bibliography in the slideshow. If any of those articles are of interest to you, if they are, just reach out to me. I can send them to you directly. And that is how I carry the message and not the wreckage. And I really want to thank all of you for joining me and playing along. And I hope I truly do hope to see you out there on the circuit. And I'll leave the room open for questions and answers. And once again, thank you so much.